Psalm 108, a psalm in which it might actually make sense that David quotes himself as a basis for his own faith.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
I'll explain why it actually might make sense for David to quote himself as a basis for his own faith as we go through the psalm. I think it will make sense to you that it's not just about David being able to do that. All of us can kind of follow that same pattern, but seeing it realized in David is important, and it is. I mentioned the ironic sense of that, though, quoting yourself as an authority, because there are a few times, I was going to say so many, but it's not that many. There are a few times when I've been having discussions with people, and sometimes about fairly in-depth issues, and what they have done to make their case is say, well, I wrote a book about this, and I say in that book, and try to make their point, to which I want to say, you're quoting yourself as the authority for your own opinion. I realize you wrote it down and someone thought it was worth putting on paper, probably at your own expense for publishing it, but that doesn't really make the point. So there's an irony built into the idea that David would write this psalm about establishing his faith, why his faith is worth having, on the basis of things that he had said in another psalm about his own faith. Now, here's the reason I say that's what's going on. The superscript of this psalm, this is Psalm 108. That's how far we are into the book of Psalms. And I realize I haven't gone through all of these with you in episodes, but I've gone through a lot of the psalms with you in these episodes. This 108th psalm is in a book of the psalms that doesn't have a lot of David's psalms in it. David's psalms are early on in the book of Psalms, and they're very organic, and you can sort of feel David out in the field writing these psalms when he does. They are of a different style than the kinds of psalms we see from the sons of Korah and things like that, which are more artistic and more refined. And I'm not trying to say that in some final statement of judgment, but that's how they come across to me, and I think it's defensible, objectively defensible, that that's the case. So it's kind of surprising to come across a psalm of David in Psalm 108, but that's the superscript to the psalm, and it's considered part of the text of the scriptures. And what's more interesting about it is that there is a notable section of this psalm that's mimicked in Psalm 57, which is also a psalm of David. It's referred to as a miktam of David, written when he fled from Saul to the cave of Adullam, and all. And so that's that part of Psalm 57 is not surprising, because you have a psalm of David, Psalm 57, blah, blah, blah. That's fine. What's interesting here is that the fifth verse of this psalm, It's a phrase you recognize. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. We have a famous song that has those lyrics in it, and so we all recognize it. And when I went through that psalm, Psalm 57, I did it as an episode here, ages ago, obviously, because it's 51 psalms ago. When I did that, we gave it a name. It was More Than Mercy, I think, was the title of the episode. Daisy will link to it. And it had a theme sort of built into that psalm, not the same as the theme here at all. The theme there was that God does practice mercy, obviously, and he gives glory in the heavens, but it's that God fills the earth with his faithfulness And he does it so much and for so long with his faithfulness in the earth that finally it sort of redounds to the heavens until they are filled with his glory. So his faithfulness in the earth ends up filling the heavens and the earth with his glory because he's so faithful here. That, Psalm 57, is now reflected in the words of these first four verses in Psalm 108, and particularly in verse 5 in that statement, "Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth." Now, a reasonable inference here to make would be this, because that psalm, Psalm 57, is a specific context. As I said, in the superscript to that psalm, it says it's written when he fled from Saul to the cave of Adullam, or it says to the cave, but it's to the cave of Adullam, when he's running away from Saul. That's when, at the very beginning of his time as the man who would become king, he's already been anointed and set apart by Samuel, but he would become king. That's when all the rabble are gathering to him. Remember, his family comes to him while he's hiding in the wilderness there. And then all the poor and the thieves and the people who were accused of this and that, they all come and gather to him. We talked about all the messianic nature of that role that David plays. That's all right at the beginning of his life and ministry and service and so on. This is later. You can tell by the names that are brought up, by the references that are brought up in it, that this comes later in his reign, this psalm, Psalm 108. And so it's a reasonable inference to make that when he faces, and it does look like they are similar, when he faces similar difficulties later in his life, that he returns to the language of that miktam, that psalm that he had written before, a psalm that gave him comfort or encouragement that God was going to continue to be faithful to him, even while he's fleeing from Saul, while he's having to run from someone who wants to kill him, and he hasn't seen the fulfillment of all the things that Samuel has said to him. Oh, you're the next king, you know. He hasn't seen the fulfillment of it, so he writes that psalm. So later in his life, not much later, I'm not saying he's an old man at this point, but later in his reign, when he's trying to lead Israel and they're having challenges, trying to achieve the things that God has already promised they're going to achieve, that he would be able to look back to that earlier psalm and say, you know, this is not the first time we've been through this. So let's see where it leads us, right? And then so he's going to use that language again. So let's do see where it leads us. And I think it's a fairly fascinating place. So the first four verses, this is a fairly brief psalm. I think it's 13 verses. The first four verses are, they sound pedantically affirmative of faith. They just step out there and say, my faith is unshakable, right? So here are the first four verses. I'm going to sort of make fun of these. I'm not really making fun of them. They're a beautiful statement of faith, obviously. But there is a part of it that, as you read the rest of the psalm, you realize this is a justifiable understanding of what's going on in these statements. So what he says here is, it's like a protestation. My faith is plenty. I've got plenty of faith. So here's how he says it, this declaration of his faith in God. My heart is steadfast, O God. Again, I'll come back and say why I'm chuckling in a minute. My heart is steadfast, O God. I will sing and make melody with all of my being. I have no doubt whatsoever. I sing and make melody with all of my being. Awake, O harp and lyre. I will awake the dawn. I will give thanks to you, O Lord, among the peoples. I will sing praises to you among the nations. For your steadfast love is great above the heavens. Your faithfulness reaches to the clouds. Those are the first four verses. In each of those four verses, there's a parallel. So there's a lot of repetition of the same idea. My heart is steadfast, O God. I will sing and make melody with all my being. Those are really the same idea. Everything in me believes in you, O God. I'm not shakable. The second verse, awake, O harp and lyre. And then the statement, I will awake the dawn, which is a very promising type of message. So there's nothing negative about this, but it is the same statement twice. And then verse 3 does the same thing. So I'm going to give thanks to you, O Lord, among the peoples. I will sing praises to you among the nations. He says it twice. In verse 4, your steadfast love is great above the heavens. Your faithfulness reaches to the clouds. Again, the same concept mentioned twice. So there's a lot of redundancy built in here, and that's not, I mean, that's fine. That's poetic. That's how you do things. You say it emphatically by repeating the concept twice and giving it in slightly different language so you have a different way of understanding just how sincerely, beautifully, poetically, aesthetically it has been stated, right? That's the idea. There is, and especially this, in those first two verses, and particularly in verse 2, the idea that he is awaking the dawn. Awake, O harp and lyre, I will awake the dawn. There is an anticipation of what is present in the rest of the psalm very strongly, and that is something is dark. There's the light has not shined yet, but I'm going to take out these words of this poem in this case, but I'm going to take out my instruments and play my instruments, and we're going to introduce beauty to this world again as if it's not already beautiful. So that little bit of a head nod to the rest of the psalm, which has to do with what God hasn't done yet. We'll get back to that in a moment. The rest of the psalm is about that. You know, who's going to lead me into this place of victory that I'm supposed to have and so on. But this part of the psalm is really staunchly seated in that place that says, my faith is already done. I'm already secure. I'm already absolutely committed to the belief that all of this is going to be fine. So I'm suggesting to you, it's sort of the language that I think we get from Hamlet, right? So or maybe it's Macbeth. I can't remember now which one it is. In the first two verses, my heart is steadfast. I'll sing and make melody with my being. Awake, O harp and lyre, I will awake the dawn. It's sort of like the lady doth protest too much, methinks, you know. Your faith is steadfast. Okay, man, I believe you. You don't have to say it over and over again. I mean, what's going on here that a person's first words are, no, my faith is not shaken. Nobody said your faith was shaken. Well, maybe somebody did. And maybe that somebody is the person who's writing the psalm. Maybe there's a part of your being that's doubting. You know, something's gone wrong. No, no, no. I sing and make melody with all of my being. I'm going to awake the dawn. Well, who said it was dark? So the point of these first four verses is to make this declaration about how absolute our faith in God is, but there is an undertone to it, and it's not even that under. There is an undertone to it that says, I need my faith to be unshakable. I need to rely on something that's not showing up for me right now the way that I want it to. And in verse 4, you get a little of that also. And again, the idea that this is more than just a basic expression of resolute faith. That it's what it says in verse 4, that his steadfast love is great above the heavens. Your steadfast love is great above the heavens. Your faithfulness reaches to the clouds. The idea in verse 4 is that his faithfulness is reaching to the clouds. But the idea in verse 3 was that I need to tell the nations about it. There's someone there who wouldn't know this. And yet his faithfulness is all to the clouds. It's in the heavens. It's everywhere, right? But somehow I will give thanks to you, O Lord, among the peoples. I will sing praises to you among the nations, those places where in some way, maybe they haven't heard it yet. Maybe they haven't seen it yet. I don't know. It's not dramatically stated, but it certainly does seem to be more than a basic expression of how resolute his faith is in verses 1 through 4. So verses 5 and 6 follow on. And there's basically an imperative. It's a plea, obviously, but it's in the form of an imperative to God for his glory to be everywhere, for it to go everywhere, for it not simply to be in the songs of my faith, but to be expressed in the world. So as I would sing it to the world, now we need you to declare it to the world, God. So in verse 5, be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. That faith in verses 1 through 4 exalts God. It does. My heart is steadfast. I'm singing and making melody. Awake, harp and lyre. Wake the dawn and give thanks to you, O Lord, among the people. So my faith wants to exalt God even among the peoples. But here in verse 5, the change is that I'm seeking the fulfillment of what I believe in verses 1 through 4. My faith is steadfast. My heart is steadfast. My belief is absolute. Now I just need you to show that to the world, God. Be exalted above the heavens and let your glory be over all the earth. That's what we want to see. So that in verse 6 of this imperative, he's saying, and here's why I'm asking you to do this, God, so that your beloved ones, which are the people of God, which is the Messiah, you know, this is the ability to equate the people of God with the Messiah is characteristic of all of the Psalms and of our reason for being able to pray them. Remember, these things are first and foremost true in their audience, Israel, but especially in the Messiah when he says these words. And David, being the Old Testament Messiah, you know, is offering us these words. So he says, so I'm saying to you, God, Yahweh, be exalted above the heavens and let your glory be over the earth for this reason, so that your people, so that your beloved ones, so that your Messiah may be delivered. Give salvation by your right hand and answer me. That statement that I need salvation, I need to be delivered, the end of evil is what's being asked for here, so that your beloved ones can be delivered, so that salvation will come by your right hand, so that you will have answered my prayers for the end of all of this evil, for the end of suffering in this world. And that will be the appearance of God's glory over all the earth, so that there is no place where your people, where your Messiah is suffering ever again. The end of evil and suffering will be the appearance of God's glory over all the earth. Now the entire earth is filled with his glory. That's why, you know, in the incarnation and the resurrection, the angels can sing that. They can say that, even knowing that the Messiah is about to suffer interminably during the 33 years that he's here, and that he's going to suffer at the hands of Pontius Pilate in that last year, in that moment of crucifixion. They can still sing about God's glory being over all the earth, the Holy Spirit himself being unhindered in the earth, because in the resurrection is this declaration that the end of faith is being realized, meaning the goal of faith, the purpose of faith is being realized, that God's glory is over the earth because evil and suffering has found its conqueror. Christ himself, the Lord of this world, now demonstrates that God's glory is over all the earth. And yet, people still suffer. Terrible things still happen in this world. And so the end of evil and suffering being equated with God's glory being over the earth makes sense, but it also makes sense that that would be the end of faith, not the end the way we use the word as the eschaton. The end, we use the word end in two different ways. And this is, it's sort of fun to explain to people in English because they don't always think through it in English, but we do use the word in both ways. You know, the end of a thing can be just its conclusion. You know, you just ran out of pages, so that's the end of the book. But the end of a thing can also be its purpose. That's a different thing. The end of evil and suffering will be the appearance of God's glory over all the earth, meaning the end of evil and suffering, just its conclusion, is going to be realized when the only thing in the earth is God's glory. God isn't glorified in the suffering of people. Now, I know he can be glorified through the suffering of people. He does that all the time. That's not my statement. That's not God's glory, though. That's why he does it. There are statements, for instance, people have a hard time understanding this. Sometimes they just forget the concept of means or how God uses things in the world. But we forget that along with statements like, you know, God's sovereignty, that he's the creator of all things. He forms the light and makes the darkness, and he creates peace and makes evil. You know, all those statements from Isaiah 45, that one, all those kinds of statements, we forget the statements that come out of the New Testament as well. And some of these are in the Old Testament, but in the New Testament as well, like he's not the author of confusion. There are things that are not the glory of God being revealed in the world, which is why the glory of God being revealed in the world is a unique reality that David is able to pray for here. There are some things that are not the glory of God being revealed in the world. We'd like for all those to cease and for only the glory of God to be revealed in the world. That's why this imperative to God is so important. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens, and let your glory be over all the earth. So that glory being revealed over all the earth will be the end, meaning the conclusion, just the finality of it, of all evil and suffering. It will be gone. That's the Revelation 21 statement. No more death, sorrow, crying, tears, all of that's gone. We look forward to that. But that, God's glory being over all the earth, is also the end of our faith. Not meaning its conclusion, well, I can't have faith anymore, God's glory is fully revealed, but meaning the purpose of it. That's what we believe in. The purpose of our faith is to arrive at that place where we know God's glory is going to be over all the earth. So how those fit together, I think, is the point of this psalm. It's integral to this psalm. So middle section of the psalm is verses 7 through 9. And it's, instead of an imperative about God fulfilling his promises and showing his glory over all the earth, is a declaration about God's promises. So now the psalmist, the Messiah, is giving us the words to understand among ourselves from him this truth of what God has offered to us. God, this is starting in verse 7, has promised in his holiness, with exultation I will divide up Shechem and portion out the valley of Sukkoth. We read through these, and this is the part where, you know, when you have a layperson reading, a lot of times it's like, oh, I'm going to skip the names, okay, y'all, and we'll just go do something else. I understand that. Believe me, I get it. Nobody wants to pronounce all these things. Fortunately, these are all pretty simple to pronounce. They're not a problem. But the names are important in this case, and where they go is important. So we're going to read it and sort of focus on it for a few minutes. So God has promised in his holiness, he says in verse 7, with exultation, in quotation marks, this is what God has promised in his holiness, with exultation I will divide up Shechem and portion out the valley of Sukkoth. Gilead is mine, Manasseh is mine, Ephraim is my helmet, Judah my scepter. All of those have specific and important content to them that we need to talk about. We'll come back to them in just a moment. Then he says in verse 9, Moab is my wash basin. Now, I love, we can take these as such insulting statements, and maybe they are. We don't know for sure how they're intended. It's possible that he's saying, I'm just going to throw my cast out of there on Moab. And upon Edom, I cast my shoe, like someone threw their shoe at George W. Bush, you know, back in the day. It's an insult to, you know, show the sole of your foot. Maybe it is that kind of insult. We don't know for sure what these idioms are expressing. But clearly, they do express this, though. They express dominion. They express that it's my possession. I can do whatever I want with it. So Moab is my wash basin. Upon Edom, I cast my shoe. Over Philistia, I shout in triumph. So verses 7, 8, and 9 has all these names of places in it, but they have a specific meaning. And for the people of Israel, obviously, the named places would be, you know, front of mind. They would know immediately what the context of those places is. For us, we give it just a little thought, and it's not difficult to realize why he's referring to the places that he refers to. So in verses 7 and 8, the places are these. God makes this promise that he's going to divide up Shechem and Sukkoth, Gilead, Manasseh, Ephraim, and Judah. And he refers to those, and we realize he's referring to them because they're places that are part of the promised land. There are parts of that promised land that are on the east side of the Jordan River where Manasseh settles, and there are parts of the promised land that are on the west side of the Jordan River where Ephraim and Judah basically divide up the whole land. And I don't mean the two tribes, but I mean the two territories where we start talking about northern Israel in general terms of being Ephraim and southern Israel as in general terms as being Judah. So obviously those are the places that are being named now. And what's interesting about this is that Shechem, in particular, the one that's named first, with exultation, I will divide up Shechem and portion out the valley of Sukkoth. When he names those, we're immediately drawn toward the book of Joshua. The references are so direct to those places, and they are so important in the book of Joshua. And then the references to all the other places that come up in the book of Joshua make it fairly easy to see that David would be pointing back to Joshua settling into the land with the people and establishing the covenant with them at this place, at Shechem, where he establishes the covenant, and naming the other places when he's talking about that covenant being fulfilled in God. So in Sukkoth, which is the settlement of Gad, that's east of the Jordan River, where, you know, Gad and Manasseh, they partially settle there. And in Joshua, by the way, we'll mention this in a moment, in Joshua, in the very first chapter, that part of the land is also mentioned explicitly, so that those people still have to remember that they're part of God's covenant with all of the people. They're not a separate people. They're just part of what God is doing in all of the land as he establishes them in it. That's in Joshua 1. I'll come back to it in a moment. But at the very end of the book of Joshua, in Joshua 24, when God is reestablishing the covenant after having given Israel the land, Joshua's about to leave. You know, he's about to die. And as he does, he puts all the people in front of him and he says, now let's reestablish that covenant. Remember, we established this at Ebal and Gerizim. We were going to do this. And so we've got to reestablish this covenant. It says in Joshua 24, the very last chapter of the book of Joshua, we're going to take a fairly substantial amount out of Joshua 24 here. He says, Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem, this place that's been named in the psalm. David writes, long after Joshua and after the kingdom has now been established, right? So after the period of the judges has gone by, and then Samuel and then Saul, and now David is the king, he points back to Joshua and says, when Joshua first brought us into this land and had won all those battles and we were established in this land, he stood up before us and said this about what God had promised to us in his holiness. He had promised to us Shechem and Sukkoth and Gilead and Manasseh and Ephraim and Judah. Now, here's how Joshua actually describes this renewal of the covenant. In Joshua 24, he gathers all the tribes of Israel to Shechem, and he summoned the elders, the heads, the judges, the officers of Israel. They presented themselves before God, and Joshua said to them, thus says the Lord God of Israel, long ago your fathers lived beyond the Euphrates, and he takes them through their journeys across the different bodies of water, across the Euphrates to get to this promised land, down into Egypt, and then across the Red Sea to get to the wilderness, and now across the Jordan River and the flood that was there, and so on. And he says in verse 11, and you went over the Jordan and came to Jericho. And the leaders of Jericho fought against you, and also the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, all these name places again, Hivites and Jebusites, and I gave them into your hand, and I sent the hornet before you, which drove them out before you. I made a promise to you, and I've done it. This is what he's saying. The two kings of the Amorites, it was not by your sword or by your bow. I gave you a land on which you had not labored, and cities that you had not built, and you dwell in them now. You eat the fruit of vineyards and olive orchards that you did not plant. So what are we supposed to take from that? Now, first of all, he's saying, I made you a promise and I kept the promise. Now I want you to keep the covenant. So in verse 14, now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in faithfulness, and put away, this is the part of Joshua 24 you probably know better than any other part, put away the gods that your fathers served beyond the Euphrates and that they served in Egypt, and instead serve Yahweh. And if it is evil in your eyes to serve the Lord, choose this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your fathers served in the region beyond the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell now. But as for me and my house, Joshua says, we will serve Yahweh. That's what we're going to do. Now, all of that covenantal renewal that Joshua does is on the basis that God had promised to give them this land, and he gave it to them. And he renews that promise and reminds them about it at the specific place of Shechem. And by the way, when you want to add to that Gilead and Manasseh, you go back to Joshua 1, and you hear Joshua saying to them, in fact, there's another part I want to include with this in just a minute. I'll bring it up in a moment about the burials at the end of Joshua 24. But let me just take a leap out to Joshua 1 for 1 minute and remind you that in Joshua 1, when they were first going into the land, Gad already had decided to settle on the east side of the river, and Joshua had blessed them with that. But he said to them, but don't forget that God expects you to go into the battle with your brothers as they fight for the land that's on the west side of the Jordan River as well. And if you don't, God will remember and he'll hold you accountable and so on, because that's part of the covenant. You have to stay faithful through all of this. Then what happens in Joshua 24 is all the burials at the end of the chapter. And these are the close to the chapter, so they're really important. Joshua 24 in verse 29 says, after these things, Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died being 110 years old, and they buried him in his own inheritance at Timnath-Serah, which is in the hill country of, it's in the psalm, Ephraim. That's what he's referring to. So I promised you, Shechem, I promised you at Sukkoth, and I promised you, Ephraim, and I promised you, Judah. You're going to have all of this, right? So in verse 31, Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua, all the days of the elders. This is in Joshua 24 again. All the days of the elders who outlived Joshua and had known all the work that the Lord did for Israel. And as for the bones of Joseph, because remember, the land is promised to Israel. So here's this guy who led them down into Egypt and blessed them there and so on and all that time. But he said, bury me in the land of our people. Don't bury me here in Egypt. So they carry his bones out. And where do they bury him? At the place that's mentioned here, Shechem, in this psalm. They buried him at Shechem in the piece of land that Jacob bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of money. It became an inheritance of the descendants of Joseph. And Eleazar, the son of Aaron, died. Where do the priests get buried? They bury him at Gibeah, the town of Phinehas, his son, which had given him in the hill country of Ephraim. So all these places that are mentioned here, and then David, obviously, is of Judah himself. Gilead, Gad, Manasseh settled there. Ephraim, the northern kingdom of Israel. Judah, the southern kingdom of Israel. All of them are about what God has already done. All of that's in verses 7 and 8. But we did verses 7 through 9. So we haven't done verse 9 yet. Why are 7 and 8 distinct? Because all of the named places in verses 7 and 8, God's already given them. God's already given David. They're already possessed. And that parallels what David is saying in the first four verses of the psalm, where he's saying, I already have faith. You've already led us into these places. I have no reason to doubt you, God. You promised these would be ours, and they are ours. This is the faith of God's chosen people. We are your people in your land with your Messiah, your King, who's ruling over us. We believe in you, and David can say that. That's all the faith that's there. That's why, when you're reading in verses 7 through 9, God promised in his holiness that he would give us Shechem, that he would portion out the Valley of Sukkoth, that Gilead would be his, that Manasseh is his, that Ephraim is his, that Judah is his. And lo and behold, it's all his. He's done exactly what he said. We don't have a reason to doubt. All of that's there in verses 7 and 8. That's the same as saying in verses 1 through 4, my faith is steadfast. But then, you know, after this, he promised he would give them the land. He gave them the land. But he also promised this. Now, this is in the language of verse 9. God has promised, Moab is my wash basin. Upon Edom I will cast my shoe, and over Philistia I shout in triumph. Now, the promise extends to where they haven't seen it realized. Now, in David's lifetime, they do. I know that. But in this psalm, they have not. You can tell because in the next verse, in verse 10, he says, who will bring me to the fortified city? Who will lead me to Edom? And have you not rejected us, O God? The things that are going to follow say that when David gives us this psalm, he's facing a crisis that doesn't show in any obvious way its resolution without God's miraculous involvement. But he still wants to believe the promise that God has given. God's made it clear that they will have these things, but he hasn't done it. Now, there are a lot of ways to say that, but this is, you know, fairly harsh. God promised, and he hasn't done it. That's the point. And that matches what we were saying earlier on in verse 6. So in verse 5, be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. Verse 6, so that your beloved ones can be delivered. Meaning, where's your glory? Give salvation by your right hand and answer me. Meaning, you're not exalted over everything right now. Something's not right. But I will exalt you. I'm going to do it. I'm going to take out my harp and while it's dark, play the music because I know the dawn is coming. That's what he's doing in those first four verses. And so in contrast with, you know, the opening statement of absolute faith comes the plea for deliverance. And in contrast with the promise that God is going to give us all the lands he's already given us, comes the reality that God has also promised things that he hasn't done yet, which we see in verse 9. Moab is my wash basin. Upon Edom, I will cast my shoe. Over Philistia, I shout in triumph. These are the places where their greatest enemies are. Sometimes they're frenemies, but in this case, they're enemies for sure. And it hasn't been realized yet. So if you, you know, if you see in verse 10 that he's asking who's going to take him into Edom, then you know they don't have Edom yet. Now, they do, again, they do see all of this realized during David's wars, and we see during, because he spends his whole career in some kind of conflict. He has very few moments of respite at all. And his conflicts are sometimes internal and sometimes external, but they're constant. That's why God says to him, your hands are covered with blood, you're not the one to build my temple, right? So we realize all of that's the case. But the fact that they are going to see it realized during David's life makes this psalm really valuable for us because we get to hear David praying it when it hasn't been realized, but he has seen God realize other things. He has seen God do plenty to make him say, yeah, I know it's not light yet, but I'm still going to take out my instruments and start playing because I know God's going to do it. So we see it fulfilled in 2 Samuel 8. After this, David defeated the Philistines. So there goes Philistia. He subdued them, and David took Metheg-Amma out of the hand of the Philistines. So when it says he subdued them, that means they start paying tribute to him. So he owns Philistia at that point. In 2 Samuel 8, the next verse, it says, and he defeated Moab. This is kind of a weird one. I'll explain why in just a second. He defeated Moab, and he measured them with a line. This is ugly. Making them lie down on the ground, two lines he measured to be put to death and one full line to be spared. And the Moabites became David's servant and brought tribute. So he conquers Moab the same way. Now, that's pretty ugly. I mean, we have captives. They are in our possession and we're taking two thirds of them and executing them. And the other third, randomly, we're letting live to go back so that they can pay tribute, so they can still live. There are a lot of different ways to interpret that, one of which is war is absolute in their day. You either win and kill everyone or you lose and everyone is killed. And he didn't do that, at least. You can say that. That's not super comforting to me or I think probably to most of us. The other odd thing about it is, I mean, for crying out loud, Moab, those are his own people. This is Ruth's people, you know, his great-great-grandmother. I mean, what's going on here? And you can say, well, that's three generations, four generations removed. No, it's not. When David's running from Saul, remember where he drops off his parents. He drops them off with the king of Moab. Hey, my parents need somewhere to stay. Can they stay here safely? Now, the rabbinic tradition or midrashic tradition says, at least in some cases, says, you know, maybe the king of Moab didn't keep that promise. Maybe he killed David's parents. Maybe abused them in some way, and so David comes back to take vengeance on them. It's sort of backfilling the story. We don't know what happened. I don't know what happened. But in that moment, it seems like they're friends. And in this moment, they're definitely not friends. But he definitely wins over Moab. He owns Moab at this point. And the last one also, the Edomites. David made this is in the same chapter, 2 Samuel 8, down around verse 13. David made a name for himself when he returned from striking down 18,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt. And he put garrisons in Edom, and throughout all Edom he put garrisons, and all the Edomites became David's servants. And the Lord gave victory to David wherever he went. In all three cases where God made a promise that as David is writing the psalm, he hasn't fulfilled, we know by the end of David's reign, he has fulfilled it. So it gives us a perspective on reading the rest of the psalm and understanding what it's supposed to mean for us. So in the last part of the psalm, verses 10 through 13, what are we supposed to take from all of this? So in verse 10, David, whose faith is unshakable, says to God, you are the one who's promised this. So he says now to everyone, who's going to bring me to the fortified city? And in saying it to everyone, he's saying to God, no one else can. You're the only one. So whoever it is that you choose to use to help, I know it's really just you, God, who's going to do it. So here's how he says it, starting in verse 10. Who will bring me to the fortified city? Who will lead me to Edom? Have you not rejected us, O God? You do not go out, O God, with our armies. This is, you promised, and yet it's not happening. Why isn't it happening? And as I've said over and over as we've gone further and further into the Psalms, God gives us this language. We don't have to pretend it's not the case. We all have things in our lives we believe God is going to do because of what God himself has said. He will comfort us. He will be with us. He will not leave us alone. And then we find ourselves alone, uncomforted. And we say to God, I know you're comforting me. I believe in you. I absolutely believe in you. And yet that thing is still down in our soul saying to us, scratching through the bottom of our heart and saying, you're alone. What do you mean you're comforted? You're miserable. Be honest. And to God, David is able honestly to say, I absolutely believe in you. I know your promises from the past. But for all the world, God, it looks like you've rejected us. Have you not rejected us, O God? You do not go out, O God, with our armies. And this is where we live in the world. That's verse 11. I haven't read 12 and 13 yet. But in verse 11, we have to pause long enough to say, that's where we live. We live in the promise, even having seen some of the promise fulfilled, but not seeing the other side of that promise fulfilled. We haven't seen it all. We still see the misery. We still see the suffering. We still see the failures. We still see places like Philistia and Edom not conquered. And we say, when are you going to take Moab? When is that going to happen? We don't have to pretend that that's not the case. We don't have to be Pollyanna-ish about it. We can be sincere in our grief and at the same time be what other people might hear as Pollyanna-ish, absolute in our faith. No, he will do it. Well, how do you know that? I mean, he hasn't done it yet, so how would you know if he hasn't done it yet? So here's what David says in verses 12 and 13. Oh, grant us help against the foe. For vain is the salvation of man. I'm not looking anywhere but to you, God. I have nowhere else to go. That's what God is always looking for. He says it over and over. He says it to the kings of Israel and Judah. I am looking for a perfect heart. Perfect doesn't mean pure without any stain whatsoever. Perfect means one that fully relies on God, has nowhere else to turn. You can go and read it in the story of Asa, which we've told on here before. The point here is that David says that vain is the salvation of man. Grant us help against this foe. And then in verse 13, a restatement of the confidence that he had at the beginning of the psalm. This is the return to the first four verses. With God, we shall do valiantly. It is he who will tread down our foes. I mean, and let's face it, this is the whole thing with David. His faith makes him charge into the battle where everyone else has reason to fear, and he has reason to fear. But because he believes God, he's just gonna go. And as he goes, everyone else joins him because they see that his faith is not in vain. So This is the whole point of the psalm. A psalm, again, written when David had seen God fulfill promises for him and put his glory in parts of the earth that they didn't ever think they would see his glory. He has seen that before, but now is in a place where he doesn't see how God is going to put his glory in those parts of the earth where it's not already present. And he comes to God and he starts out by saying, my faith is absolute. I believe you, God, because you promised two different things. One that you've already fulfilled, but another that you haven't. But I'm going to use the words you gave me before you fulfilled the first promises, and then you fulfilled it. I'm going to use those words as my assurance in this case that you are still going to fill all of the earth with your glory. And that's where our faith lives. Our faith lives where those promises are in some cases fulfilled and in other cases are not fulfilled. We have faith precisely because God has not yet fulfilled the remainder or the substance of his promise, but we still believe he will. That's the definition of faith that's given to us in Hebrews 11. These all died in faith. You know, this substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen, that chapter. These all died in faith, not having received the things that were promised. He's talking about, in this case, Abel and Noah and Abraham. These all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles in the earth. Exactly what David is when he says, "You haven't given this to us yet. Who is going to take me to these places we're supposed to go to?" For people, as the author of Hebrews goes on, for people who speak thus make it clear that they're seeking a homeland. But if they had been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, Egypt, for instance, they would have had opportunity to return, or to the other side of the Euphrates for Abraham. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, because he's prepared for them a city, not because they've realized all of the things he's promised for them, but because he's promised it for them, and they still regard themselves as his people because of the promise. Just because of the promise. The perpetual irony of our faith is that we are most established in it when we don't need it, and in most need of it when we are least likely to have it. There is nothing I can do to explain faith more than that concept. God has made a lot of promises that he hasn't fulfilled. That sounds insulting, but it's not. This is the world we live in. We live between the promises. God has made a lot of promises he hasn't fulfilled, at least not in the way we're bound to believe he will ultimately fulfill them. Lions lying with lambs, death everywhere, dormant, pain, only a relic of past experience, hope, a word without meaning, because all we could ever hope for is already realized around us. So where do we find faith when we need it and don't have it? At least one place is looking back to the place we had faith because we didn't need it. Back to those times when God had done, in all of his crazy and mysterious ways, exactly what he said he would. First and foremost, and always from that day forward, in the incarnation, the death, the resurrection of the Messiah, promised from the creation itself, that's the promise we look back to and say, when I doubt anything else, when I lack the faith that I need the most now, I can look back in faith on that thing that absolutely proved God is going to finish what he started. In short, that kind of faith is the will to say, God, you've shown up in my life before. Now, be exalted, O God, above the heavens, and let your glory be over all the earth, including where my life is now.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.